Hi, this is Ruzbeh Hidari, director of Neon Lights.
Hi, I'm Dane Abraham, the writer and star of Neon Lights, and you're listening to
The Great Dog Show.
Welcome to the graveyard.
And welcome to another edition of the Graveyard Show podcast. I am your caretaker, and the graveyard is open. As you heard at the top of the show, Ruzbeh Hidari and Dana Abraham will be here in just a moment to talk about their new film, Neon Lights. Now, Ruzbeh is the director of the film, and Dana stars and is the screenwriter of the film. Both gentlemen also came up with the story. So in just a moment, we're going to talk about Neon Lights, which is coming to On Demand and Digital starting July 12th. But before I get to that, I wanted to talk about going to the movies, something that, I don't know how many of you have been actually going out and seeing movies in the theaters lately. Obviously, with the pandemic, a lot of that has changed things. And obviously, with the evolution of televisions and streaming and everything else that we could do here at home, it has certainly changed the way we go to the movies as well. But my wife and I went to the movies for the first time in several years. It was the first movie actually we saw since The Invisible Man. We went to see that right before the lockdowns happened. And we wound up going back to the same movie theater not too far from us here in our graveyard. And we went to see the new Top Gun movie, Maverick. And, you know, it's such a great movie. Everything that I had heard about this film came true. It was just amazing. It was action. It was emotional. It was just full of fun and pride and everything else that that you get when you go see a Top Gun movie. And I have to say that, man, that movie just paid off. And if you haven't seen it yet, I really highly suggest you check it out in a movie theater. It's just one of those things that you have to see in a movie theater. That's not a Star Wars movie or a superhero movie. You know, it's just a, you know, regular film action movie, I guess you could call it. That you just go and you just see, and it was so well done, and it blends so well with the original, the way it was shot, the way it looks, the way it feels. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. And it was funny because, you know, the movie's been doing so well over these last few weeks. And after the movie, I heard a couple of the moviegoers talking. They just met. And sort of middle-aged guy talking to an older gentleman. And the older gentleman's like, yeah, this is my fourth time seeing this. I was like, oh, my God. And the middle-aged guy says, are you going to go again? He goes, yeah, probably not. You know, I think I've seen it enough. And it's like, well, that's why this film is doing so well, is because you get that incredible return business that people are just going back to see it and see it and see it again. So I just wanted to throw that out there. If you have not seen Top Gun Maverick and you want to go see a really solid movie on a big screen, highly recommend it. Check it out. All right, getting back on topic. If you'd like to reach out to me, actually, if you have seen Top Gun, and you want to talk about that, you want to email me, you can do so at gyspodcast@gmail.com. gyspodcast@gmail.com is the email address. Thoughts, comments, suggestions, commentary, and of course, if you're part of the horror community and you would like to promote something, get in touch with me through gyspodcast@gmail.com. Some of you have already taken advantage of that, and I appreciate that, because that's why the show is here, to help promote, especially those of you out there in the world of independent horror. Now, before my guests get here, let's get into the news. RLJE Films and Shudder have acquired the new film Slashback, an alien invasion thriller that recently premiered to rave reviews at this year's South by Southwest. Now, the film is expected to be released in theaters and on VOD digital before streaming on Shudder later in the year. Slashback is the feature directorial debut of Nyla Inuksuk, Naya also co-wrote the film with Ryan Cavan. Critics have embraced the film after it debuted at South by Southwest, with Variety's Peter DeBrugg writing, indigenous director Nyla Inuksuk imagines an alien invasion thriller that works on multiple levels, empowering the community in which she made it. He went on to compare the film to cult favorite Attack the Block, adding that Slashback seems bound to find that same cult following. Set in the mountains of Baffin Island in the Arctic Ocean, Slashback opens as the village wakes up to a typical summer day. But for Micah and her ragtag friends, things change after they discover an alien invasion threatening their hometown. Using makeshift weapons and their horror movie knowledge, they battle back against the intruders. There's a trailer out for the new film Gone in the Night. The film stars Winona Ryder, John Gallagher Jr., Owen Teague, Brian Chu, and Dermot Mulroney. Eli Horowitz co-wrote and directed the film. He is the co-creator of Homecoming. In the film, Kath, played by Ryder, and her boyfriend, played by Gallagher Jr., arrive at a remote cabin in the Redwoods, only to discover that a mysterious younger couple is already there. The rental has apparently been double booked, and with nowhere else to go, they decide to share the cabin with these strangers. When her boyfriend disappears with the young woman, Kath becomes obsessed with finding an explanation for their sudden breakup, but the truth is far stranger than she could have ever imagined. In some home video news, Sony Pictures Home Entertainment will celebrate the 30th anniversary. 30 years already? My gosh. 30th anniversary of Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Wow, that's crazy. With a brand new 4K Blu-ray Steelbook edition of the film, which will be available for purchase on October 4th. Along with the extras that were included on the Blu-ray, the 4K Blu-ray is going to contain the newly added Love Song for a Vampire music video by Annie Lennox. Man, that song gets in my head and it just stays there when I hear it. It's a great song, but man, it just burrows right in there. Also newly added Bloodlines, Dracula, The Man, The Myth, The Movies featurette. It's also going to be in Dolby Atmos Audio 5.1 and Dolby Stereo, as well as Dolby Vision HDR presentation of the film, including the original theatrical English subtitle font for texted instances. Scream Factory has two new releases headed to Blu-ray, The She-Creature and a personal favorite of mine, The Flesh Eaters. First, let's take a look at The She-Creature. The stunningly lovely assistant to a fiendish hypnotist finds the beast within her unleashed in this driving classic. Andrea Talbot becomes a pawn in the deadly intentions of Dr. Carlo Lombardi, who uses his sinister powers to regress her to a past life as a prehistoric humanoid monster from the ocean's depths. Using Andrea to commit shocking and vengeful murders, Dr. Lombardi's crimes go unchecked until his assistant turned assassin slowly begins to take control of her hideous new form. Also included on the Blu-ray will be the Mystery Science Theater 3000 Presents The She-Creature, Radio Spot Photo Gallery, and optional English subtitles for the main feature. Now, one of my favorites, and I find very underrated, The Flesh Eaters. Director Jack Curtis offers you a feast to die for with The Flesh Eaters, a flight chartered by a petulant film actress and her secretary goes haywire when a storm and engine trouble force their down-on-his-luck pilot to land on a remote island. But this island is inhabited by Professor Peter Bartell, a scientist with a disturbing past and an even more disturbing present. Experimenting on mysterious microbes existing in the waters surrounding the island, Professor Bartell hopes to cultivate them into insatiable monstrosities capable of eating their prey's skin in the blink of an eye. An early entry in the splatter film subgenre, The Flesh Eaters boasts a screenplay by comics writer Arnold Drake, co-creator of four color favorites, Doom Patrol, Dead Man, and the original Guardians of the Galaxy. The Blu-ray will have a new 2K restoration from the best available elements, alternate cut of the film in standard def, audio commentary on the alternate cut with writer-producer Arnold Drake, filmmaker Fred Olin Ray, and author, film historian Tom Weaver. Flesh Eater's Daughter, an interview with actress Leanne Curtis, Outtakes, storyboard gallery, image gallery, poster and lobby card gallery. So lots of galleries. Trailers and optional English subtitles for the main feature. Flesh Eaters, I find, is, like I said, it's very underrated, and it's one of my all-time favorites. Used to be on in the New York, New Jersey area back in the day on, I want to say, Channel 5. And there's still one sequence in that movie that's very haunting. And I remember as a kid seeing it, just being like, oh my gosh. So if you have not checked out Flesh Eaters, I highly recommend it. It's really just fantastic. Moving on to books, author David A. Newman has a new release out called Kaleidoscopic Shades Within Black Eternity. In the book, we follow Bob Triplow, an inventor who had relocated with his wife Sue from Adelaide, Australia, to Corona, California. Bob's past, however, haunts him and is threatening to come not only for his own sanity, but is also determined to claim his son Joshua. You can find Kaleidoscopic Shades Within Black Eternity at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, and Bookshop. And rounding out the news, Waxworks Records is happy to announce that the 1974 soundtrack to Black Christmas is now available on vinyl. They say that they are excited to announce that Black Christmas, the original 1974 motion picture soundtrack LP by Carl Zittrer, is shipping right now, and it features the complete soundtrack on 180-gram Blood and Garland swirl-colored vinyl. The artwork is done by Gary Poulin. Composer liner notes, deluxe packaging, and the infamous phone calls from the movie, and more. So limited stock remains, so if you want to check that out, go to Waxworks website, and you can order it there. All right, let's quickly look at some notes. As I'd mentioned previously, there's going to be a flash sale for the 1980s science fiction super documentary In Search of Tomorrow. That's going to run from July 21st through August 7th. So if you want to learn more about that, go to 80sscifidoc.com. That is 80sscifidoc.com. You can learn more about that. If you have not seen it, I highly, highly recommend it. Staying on topic, the team that brought you the soundtrack to In Search of Tomorrow, talking about Jamie Chambers and Don McLennan Jr., otherwise known as Weary Pines, they are currently working on the latest soundtrack for In Search of Darkness Part 3. And if you would like to buy any of their soundtracks, you can visit them at their website, wearypines.com, WearyPines.com, wearypines.com. You can buy their soundtracks there, and they just redid their website, and it looks fantastic. I emailed Jamie the other day letting him know it just looks just fantastic. It looks great, and really happy to see that all is going well with them. And if you just stream music, or if you just have to just stream music, but if you do stream music, which I guess, well, all of us do now, if you could check them out on whatever streaming platform you're listening on, it helps with the algorithm. So whether it's Spotify, Apple, or wherever you stream your music, if you could just listen to some of their tracks on there, I know the boys would really greatly appreciate it. It just helps them out and gets them noticed on the streaming platform. All right, on the other side of the interview, I'm going to give you some information regarding the Graveyard Show podcast and some new material that's online as well for that. But as you hear in the background, there are some new graves being added. And when that happens, that means my guests are here, and it's time for me to get to work. Joining me now is the team behind the film Neon Lights, Ruzbe Haydari, the director of the film, and Dana Abraham, the star and screenwriter of the film. Neon Lights will be available on demand and digital on July 12th. And it's a pleasure welcoming both Ruzbe and Dana to the Graveyard. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us. The caretaker, legendary.
In my own mind, but thank you. I appreciate that. So, Ruzbe, why don't you tell us what the film is about?
Neon Lights is an exploration of the human mind and how it deals and heals trauma.
Okay, there you go. I love it. So, now I know that, Dana, you wrote the script, but the two of you came up with the actual story. So, where did the idea come from, and how did you end up putting it together?
Well, I came up with the original screenplay for Neon Lights a couple of years ago, and when Ruzbe and I had met in at the height of the pandemic, we just kind of pretty much bonded, fell in love with our ideas, and then just really went pitching and catching with every sort of detail that we could in order to create a project. And Neon Lights was at the forefront of that. But the biggest contribution that both of us made was understanding, okay, this is a great project, but let's distill it. Let's make it more of a psychological thriller in the sense of, boiling down the characters. So, because, the biggest issue we were having with the pandemic was we couldn't have 30 extras and 20 other cast members and 100 different locations because everything was so restricted. That really condensed our story down to the main, structure of it, which is about mental health, childhood trauma, financial familial failure, and romanticism. And yet, despite making all of these different changes, the cinematic aspects of the film still stayed intact, much to the credit of Ruzbe and his team. And that's really how we just constructed the story. Ruzbe's been involved right from the first page, and we really just worked on the story completely and ensured that whatever that we had on the final day before we went to camera was something that we were going to be excited about when we were done filming.
So, and we're also super passionate about, let me just add this, mental health. I think it's a subject that's near and dear to both Dana and I, and we feel like we should talk about it and bring it to conversation and, bring it to the forefront of people's minds.
Yeah, and that was something that came to mind immediately within like the first couple of minutes of this film, something I wanted to talk to you about, which I'll get into in just a moment. Ruzbe, why don't you talk about your relationship with Dana, working with him and putting the story together, and was the idea to have the completed script ready to go? I know it's hard when you're on location and you're doing stuff. Things are always changing. So was the idea trying to actually make this as tight as possible so when you began filming, there wouldn't be very many changes?
I believe that the film is made in prep and the shoot is just one step towards, getting the materials required to build the house. But I truly believe in the prep and pre-production process. And Dana and I worked diligently to prepare this film before, for months before. And if you take a look at the shooting script and you take a look at the final product, it's pretty bang on. Like, the one things that may have changed, but we did include them in the script, was I would workshop lines with actors because I really wanted the actors to make the characters their own. And then Dana would implement those changes into the screenplay because that's your blueprint and that's what you go off of. And we really believe that. And we shot this in such a short time that we wouldn't have time to do anything but that. So we really, 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 really tried to get our ducks in a row, so to speak, and just execute that on the day.
So this is a very modern day story where you have this young man, Clay, who, Dana, you play in the film. He's going through, as we just talked about, he's got mental health issues going on, right? He's this embattled CEO of his tech company. He's going through high levels of stress, pressure, and he's potentially losing his company. And the underlying feeling that he's going crazy. So as an actor, as well as a screenwriter, how did you get inside Clay's head to make this work? Because you play it almost opposite of what you would expect in a lot of films like this, where it's the, it's sort of the character who's kind of just, loud and obnoxious and just kind of going, crazy. And you played it very inward. How was that putting together for you?
Well, it really just comes down to Ruzbe and I really workshopping the character. I mean, I remember when I was first constructing the character, I just knew I wanted to create something subtle and something real. Because as you had described it, how a typical character of a tech tycoon who's unraveling mentally, would be played, you're absolutely right. And I just felt like that would almost become a caricature rather than something a lot more authentic and genuine. Because, struggling with depression and mental health issues myself throughout my entire 20s, I just felt like a lot of my complexities were always introverted. They were always things that I dealt with on my own time, and never really allowed the world to kind of get a glimpse inside of it. Clay's difference between Clay and myself is that he just can't really, he doesn't have an off switch, or he doesn't, or an on switch of like where he just shows up and it's game time for him. And all of a sudden he can be this really excited, extroverted individual. But to create the character, Ruz and I really worked on the minutiae, the smaller, finer details of his hand gestures or his glances, how he looks at people or his mentalities. And just really went back to the technicals that I've learned in school. Because, you know, at the end of the day, I've never had a lead role of this caliber before, or a lead role for that matter in general. And so I really had to just kind of learn on the job and learn by doing. And Ruz and I would workshop everything and rehearse everything throughout days, about 3 months out. So I lost a little bit of weight. Ruz didn't like that enough, so I lose a little bit more, whatever looked as best as possible. We worked on, you know, his giggles and the way he'd look at people and how he'd react to things and what he thought about certain things, what he thought about sex, what he thought about food, what he thought about wine. And just the finer details is what really led me to then manifest Clay internally in order to bring him outwardly for the world to see and for Ruz to capture. And again, testament to Ruz, like another big aspect of Ruz is he's such a hard worker. I mean, show me another director that would create blueprints from AutoCAD of like the layouts of like the location. So for me, seeing that only inspired me to work on even the finer details of Clay. So that way I could give him the best that I could give him for somebody who's working so hard to capture something that I had to portray. So really just came down to just playing pitch and catch together.
So Ruz Bey, as the director, obviously, you knew the story going into it, being one of the creators of the story, but you have this sort of character profile. You have, what, five characters, six characters that are in a house. As far as shooting it for you, how did you go about attacking this film without giving things away?
Well, obviously, the best way to explain something and then the most effective way to explain something is to have a full understanding of what you're talking about. So I really had to dive deep with the script and just live and breathe with it. And, you know, there night after night, I fell asleep, like holding the script as I'm going over it.
You know,
I just didn't detach myself from it, because in order to shoot something like this, well, you kind of have to know it better than anyone else who's going to read it, in order to give your cinematographer direction, your actor's direction, your editor direction. Like, you just have to be able to, you know, breathe this story. And I think that's kind of how I took this on.
What's interesting to me, well, there are two other things. Mental health obviously being the primary underlying theme in this film. There were two other things that stood out for me. One was there was an interesting juxtaposition of the new with this, you know, with this modern day world of tech versus the old, which is inside Clay's house and the decorations. And I was wondering if there was something purposely done with that in the script, if you were trying to say something.
Well, to be honest, when I was first writing this screenplay, we kind of contacted a locations manager and started looking and hunting for a location. I remember when Ruz and I walked through this particular location in Ancaster, Ontario, which is a suburb in Hamilton where we shot it. It just made a lot of sense. It mimics so much variety of different locations that we wanted. But when it came down to the artistic and production design and the vision behind that, I think that's more Ruz Bay than it is myself. I think I mapped out the story within the confinement of the location, but Ruz really came up with the design. So Ruz, I'll let you take it away from here, man.
Yeah, I mean, Dana called me one day and he said, hey, I have two locations I want to show you. One of them is really cool. One of them we'll see after. So we went to the first one. And I remember as we were going through the gates of this property, just the emotions and energy that took over me before even getting to see the inside of the house. I looked over. I was like, this is it. Didn't I?
Yeah.
I was like, this is it. And then once we got into the house, I was really convinced. And Dana being, you know, so clever and quick, actually started tweaking the mechanics of scenes in the screenplay to fit the geography. But if you look at the design of what's in the shots, it's full of symbols and metaphors, and there's little things that you can catch on that just layer to the story. And you know, I think in a way, the old versus new comment that you have, the way I saw it was, Clay just hanging on to bits of tradition. You know what I mean? Because he's such a tech guy, and he, you know, he's working with technology that's so advanced. I mean, that to me was a representation of him hanging on to something human and traditional.
One of the things I learned from Clay was never to be late. Always be on time.
And you know what? Roosevelt's learned that about Dana too, so it's okay. It's pretty much the same thing.
That's great.
I'm early for everything now after meeting Dana. I'm like, all right, I'm sitting around for half an hour.
Roos and I talk, and like half the reason why I don't date is because they're like 2 minutes late and I just leave dinner. So it's like, it doesn't
work. Oh, that's
so
great.
That's a real thing.
So Roosevelt, let's talk about shooting this film during the pandemic. So as far as the restrictions goes, how did you guys plan it out? How was it in terms of looking at the daily schedule going, okay, well, you know, having things on standby as a just in case? What was it like working on set, you know, in these conditions?
The first thing that jumped out to me, and this I know this doesn't sound like much, but you know, in order to create atmosphere with lights on film, every shot you see in a film is hazed. There's haze, there's atmosphere to create those shafts of light. And we were told that we couldn't haze because of COVID and nobody knew what really was going on. So we accepted it. And, you know, that was visually one of the biggest challenges is, okay, we got to light these big indoor scenes with, and it's got to be moody lighting, but we can't haze, so we can't create that atmosphere. You know, we really worked hard, and Dimitri, our cinematographer, really tried to wrap his head around that and how to light without haze. Second of all, and this is a testament to the cast and crew of this film and how much they really wanted to see it cross the finish line. We essentially lived in a bubble. Like, we didn't all live together. A lot of us did. But nobody was going out on the weekends. Nobody was visiting friends over the weekend. Everyone was so committed. And thankfully, not one person got sick during this time. Not one person. We had that little app on, you know what I mean? Yeah. And not one person came close to a case. So, you know, really, we had things on standby. But we were just putting all the trust and faith into the universe and into each other. We really trusted each other. And, you know, I'm so thankful that there was no hiccups, no bumps. And we were so efficient that one time I went to Dana and I was like, I pulled him aside and I was like, Dana, it's like an hour and a half left in the day. I got nothing left to shoot. He's like, shoot something.
I was so mad. I was like, yo, you're wasting time. I paid for this to shoot it. No, you know, the one thing I'll add is Dale McLean, our first AD, he essentially, when we were looking for a first AD, he interviewed us, Roos and I, and he wanted to make sure that we knew what we were doing. He's never worked with us before, and he's so well experienced. I mean, what is it, Roos? 30 plus years he's been a first AD. He's worked on so many stars' first ever films and so many directors' first ever films. And so he kind of really well versed in how to schedule. And he's so calm. He's so collected. He's an AD that just doesn't really need to raise his voice. And if he ever does, you know that there's something really significantly wrong. Then coupling that with the logistics and the mapping and the planning of where are we going to keep the crew? Where's, you know, the actors are going to be kept and how are we going to eat? And, you know, despite being one of the first productions coming back out, specifically in the independent world and the height of the second wave, we actually executed on all levels phenomenally. And that's just a testament towards the entire crew, cast, team, medic team, executive producers who worked tirelessly to ensure funding was there when we needed it. And, you know, we're just super grateful. Roos and I would just show up and do our jobs that we prepared for. But everybody did risk a lot. And, you know, as he said, everybody would stay in. They were really careful, and that just goes down to their character, and that has nothing to do with us. It just has to do with them.
Well, that's great, because I mean it does take a commitment, and you know I'm glad to hear that everyone took it seriously that way, because it's too easy for people to just kind of sneak off and just do their thing, and then the next thing you know you got a problem, and that's fantastic, especially when you're doing independent stuff. It's like time is money. And there's not always enough of the money.
can I give a little secret?
Yeah.
clever Dana secret.
One, Dana? Yeah, go ahead. I know what you're saying.
So brilliantly, one day he comes up to the execs and I, and he's like, "All right, how about we just have the Thursday and or a Saturday." Off.
No, it's Sunday to Thursday shoot, so that we don't have Thursday. A Saturday night out.
Yeah, because they have to come to work on Sunday morning.
Smart.
That was brilliant. I mean, I'll never forget that. That was brilliant.
That is awesome. That's great. You know, more productions should take that into consideration because that really, that would make a difference.
Well, I mean, if you don't have a Saturday night out, there's nothing you can do. I mean, nobody really goes out Friday nights. You just came home from work, so you're tired. So nobody really goes out those days. So I figured if I take away a Saturday night and become Sunday for them, it's less likely. They have one less day that where they can go out, right? So, I mean, again, it goes down to the character. I'm not saying that I manipulated them into, you know, being great people and just like being caring. I think our entire crew was just incredible regardless. But I mean, it's something that I use in the project subsequent to that and worked then too. So I'm going to keep trying it.
Nice. Well done. Speaking of, well, we talked about the crew. I'd like to talk about the cast. You were able to get a twofer when casting Kim Coates. You cast Kim as Denver, and you were also able to get his daughter, Brenna Coates, to play Clay's doctor. So was that by chance or was that on purpose?
Nope. So how the situation Brenna worked out was I emailed Gail, I believe, enough times that I'm pretty sure, and I make this joke, but it's kind of real. Like, I thought she was going to get a restraining order against me with how many times I was emailing her. Ruth, I was emailing her a lot. And
Gail is Kim's agent, just in
sorry about that. Yeah, Gail is Kim's manager. And
gotcha.
I just kept emailing her, trying to lock Kim in and try to get him to read the script. And she just, the first email I remember, she just said no outright. And she kept going back, and she's like, "All right, well, you're persistent. I'll get the script in front of him." And she threw down a note where she said, "You know, this therapist that you have, if you can, you know, bring the age down a bit, I just think there's, you know, a great way where you can get Brenna involved as well. The two of them really are looking to work on a project together." And what she was throwing down, Ruz and I picked up. So we were able to really work her into the screenplay. And, you know, at the end, it just worked out so perfectly. Like, it was a brilliant, brilliant move on Gail's part that, you know, inevitably really made the screenplay just that much better.
And I will say this too, again, testament to Dana's quick thinking on his feet and effective thinking. Originally, there was no scenes where the two characters played across from each other, but, you know, we wanted to make something special out of this arrangement. So Dana went again, retooled the script in a way that added to it and in a way that they would get screen time together. Mm-hmm. and made it meaningful as well, right? So that was, I think that was special for not only us, but for them as well as a father-daughter
for sure.
Duo.
For sure.
So Danny, you got to work with Kim a lot in this. He had an amazing presence in this film. Mm-hmm. And it was understated as well. So what was it like working with him?
I mean, he's such a brilliant performer. There's a reason why, specifically even, I mean, in the world, but it's specifically in Canada, he's looked at as such a large legend. And for me, Kim's really had high esteem for a really long time. To give you perspective, Sons of Anarchy is a really big show, especially where I grew up in Hamilton, Ontario. Like, it's bike culture is a really big culture here. I learned to ride motorcycles because of Sons of Anarchy. Then his second show that he led in was Bad Blood. And Italian culture, the mafia, mob culture, if you will, is really prevalent here as well. And that's what Bad Blood's about. It's about the Hamilton families and the Montreal families. So Kim Coates is just somebody that we really respected, including my friend group. So then you fast forward and you're working with them a couple of years down the line. It's just something at first is kind of awestruck. I remember Ruz and I had the first Zoom call with him. He's in his hometown and he's hanging out by the river and he's talking to us and he's basically interviewing us, making sure we're not too nuts people, because who's making films during the second wave, especially two first time lads. And we just fell in love with him. He's such a good, gentle human being. But then his work ethic, his drive, his strategy on how he prepares and what he's thinking about and the notes he gave us, everything was just so brilliant that you know that it comes from wisdom and experience. So naturally you pick up that level of confidence when you get to work with him on a set, when he's kind of telling you and giving you words of affirmation. And then he plays pitch and catch with you. You know, if we'd ad-lib, he'd ad-lib. Like, it's just so brilliant. And then once he's kind of off and his character wrapped up and he was on his way onto the next show, we had that level of standard. And remember we said this on the Friday night when he packed up and left. We said, this is the standard now, and we're going to carry this the rest of the production. And so that's what he does. He sets a standard in the modus operandi, and you just kind of continue on forward from that point on. And that's what it's like working with Kim. But I have to add that despite his level of ability to perform, Kim's a better human being. So you can take it however you will because he's a brilliant performer, but he's actually a better human being. And I look at him as a mentor and a father figure. And the relationship we have, Ruse and I, with him and Brenna is just something of, almost like a family.
I wanted to ask about the neon lights that were used in the film. They reminded me of a Bava or Argento film, and I was wondering if any of those films had influenced you or if you were fans of those.
Well, for me,
you can't see it, but I have a Goblin poster on my wall signed by Goblin, who did the soundtrack to Suspiria. And so, yes, Argento was huge influence for me visually, but also the Mask of the Red Death. I don't know if you've seen that one.
It's one of my favorites, Corman. I think that's Corman's best movie, but that's just my opinion. That is,
and so visually, yes, those were the two for me.
I can see that very clearly now. I didn't consider Mask of the Red Death. I love that movie. Whenever that movie is on, especially in October, I'm locked. I think it's a very underrated Corman film. I think a lot of his other movies get more credit than that. But
and Vincent Price, how can you go wrong?
I know, right? Jeez. So if people want to follow the film online, or if they want to follow either one of you on social media, do you have a presence online?
Absolutely. I'm at I Am Dane Abraham, and they can also follow Red Hill Entertainment, E1 Films, or Momentum_Pics on Instagram, and Ruse.
And I am at Ruse Hidari, and we also have at Neon Lights Film.
Fantastic. Well, listen, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to join me here in the graveyard. It was great having you here. Congratulations on the film. Can't wait to have you back on for your next film. It was great having you on the show. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you so much, man. It means a lot.
Thanks for having us.
And as I put this interview to rest, I want to again thank Ruse and Dana for joining me here on the show. It was great having them here. And again, Neon Lights, on demand and digital, starting July 12th. This was one of those interviews I didn't think I was going to get, and it certainly had nothing to do with my guests. I had, more than a little bit of a problem, I had a very big problem. There's a very popular audio software that I use that is subscription-based, and my yearly subscription ran out and didn't realize that it was tied to the actual software itself. So when I went to open it, well, there was nothing there. So I had to go to a backup software that I've never used for the Graveyard Show, so I had to scramble putting it together, making sure everything worked, especially for this interview, because there's nothing worse than saying hello to someone and they don't hear you. Had that happen once already this year, not a fan of it. And that time was because of a faulty cable. Or a faulty operator, in my instance. You just never know. But anyway, very pleased to have them on the program. It was great meeting them, and I wish them well with this film. And definitely look forward to having them back on the program for their next film. Now, in the meantime, if you listen to the Graveyard Show podcast as a podcast, I highly recommend that you subscribe to the Graveyard Show podcast's YouTube channel, because while there's a lull between shows like this particular instance, there is still material that I'm uploading to YouTube, such as the old BC's Video Vault segments. I just uploaded two more of those, and there are two to go, which will be uploading soon, as well as some of the old horror promos that I have from 2009 and 10 from many of the shows from the old horror podcasting network days. And I don't think, though, many, if any, really are still around. So I grouped a bunch of them together, put them together, and uploaded them to YouTube. So check it out. I think there are about five up right now. And I'm also going to be uploading the old Graveyard Show podcast promos from 9, as well as some of the sponsor voiceovers that I did for the show. And also the caretaker appearances on other podcasts that I did back in the day, which was always fun to do. Now, I want to mention something else, because one of these appearances that I did was for the Splat Academy Awards for the Splattercast podcast. And it's it was the rare time that myself and my fill-in host, The Undertaker, otherwise known as Rich Peterson from Madison Horror, appeared together on the program, and we were announcing the nominees for Best Horror Television Show. And it was really fun going back and listening to it. And what I wanted to say was, off of that, I'm going to be starting to upload some of the old Graveyard Show classics back when The Undertaker was filling in on the program. And, you know, it's something that's long overdue, and it's something that I've been wanting to do for a while. You know, Rich's contributions to the show back in 2009 and part of 10 have always been greatly appreciated by me. He picked up the show when I was just going to kind of just let it sit there and just do nothing. And he picked it up. He took it on. He hosted. He edited it. He got the guests. And, you know, I think it's long overdue to start featuring the interviews that he did with many of the guests that he had on back in that time period. So I'm going to start putting those together fairly soon. And once I do, I will get them up and I will let you know when they are up. So The Undertaker is coming to the Graveyard Show very, very soon. In the meantime, I wanted to also invite you to join me on my latest endeavor, Catacombs of Horror. It can be found on YouTube, as well as on the Graveyard Show podcast's YouTube channel. There is a link for it. You can go on, click on it. It'll take you right to where you need to be. It's a video production that I have produced exclusively for YouTube. Currently, there are three videos you can watch. What Best Represents 1980s Horror, Favorite Scenes from Count Yorga Vampire, very, very popular, and the newest video are my favorite scenes from H4, The Return of Michael Myers, the missed opportunity the Halloween series could have taken, and why I think H4 is the most important movie in the series outside the original. That is the most disappointing one, because Halloween fans, I don't know where you guys are. So it's going to make me think twice to do another video about Halloween. But Count Yorga Vampire is just killing it out there. I want to thank everybody for their comments and their likes on that video. It's very, very popular, and it has taken off even more so than I ever could have imagined. So thank you for that. So again, Catacombs of Horror, you can find it on YouTube. The Graveyard Show podcast, as I just mentioned, is available everywhere podcasts exist, and of course on YouTube as well. We can find Catacombs of Horror. If you know anyone who is a fan of horror, please invite them to enter the graveyard. New listeners and friends are always welcome. In the meantime, my friends, I look forward to seeing you again very soon. And as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you to please lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.